Good afternoon. Welcome to the Wednesday, May 5th meeting of the HF 1650 Conference Committee. No, I'm being corrected.
House File 1065.
1065. Right numbers, wrong order. House File 1065, Conference Committee with members of the House and the Senate. Thank you all for being here, Mr. Chair, thank you for coming so quickly from the floor. Appreciate that. And to the Senate members, other Senate members as well, thank you. What we would like to do with on the House side today is hear from a couple of more speakers. We're very lucky to have a national speaker willing to come join us today. It is one of the benefits, I must say, of all of this remote Zoom work, is it does make us more accessible to presenters and testifiers who otherwise would not have been available to us. Then we do recognize we've got the finance sheets to go over, and nonpartisan staff will assist us with that. And then the House wants to just raise a few same provisions, talk about them a little bit. I recognize that the Senate is not prepared to act on those today, and that's fine. But we'll just touch on those and hope for the best. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to introduce Jeffrey Nagel, Dr. Jeffrey Nagel, who's Chief of External Impact at Clayton Early Learning and past President and Chief Executive of the Erickson Institute. He was good enough to come to the House's event in March of last year. You saw some of the video from other speakers on Monday of that event. Today he's joining us remotely, and we appreciate it. With that, Dr. Nagel, please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Sure. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Nagel. I am with Clayton Early Learning in Denver, Colorado, where I'm the Chief of External Impact. And it's great to be with you all today. Let me just do a sound check. Everyone hear me okay? Great. And I'll be sharing my screen here. And if sometimes, you know, with Zoom and whatnot, the slides stop moving, is that they're moving on my screen. So if there's any problem, I'll look for Sarah or the chairman to give a little wave and I'll know there's a hiccup. Anyway, it's great to be back with you. Of course, I was last there in Minnesota on March 6th. Just 6 or 7 days before our world shut down. So it's nice to re-engage with all of you and, you know, hopefully in an optimistic moment where a sense of normalcy is around the corner. Anyway, so I'll be talking about the importance of early childhood experience, and you'll hear me stress that word experience and not just early childhood education as I move through this presentation. And what I'd like to do, since I am talking to Education Committee, you know, a piece of history that we may or may not all kind of remember is that Horace Mann really designed our education system back in the late 1840s and into the early 1850s, and it very much is still the education system we have today. But of course, we know a lot more today about how young children develop than Horace Mann and others knew back in his day. And I think the challenge for all of us in leadership positions is to take that new knowledge and build a much more robust and impactful education system for our children, which means then ultimately the future of our state and country. Now, that system that he built was one that was of universal access, non-sectarian. It was free. It was for both boys and girls. It was ages 5 to 14. The high school came after the Civil War. It was tax funded, it was compulsory, it had trained teachers, which was a new concept, and it was a quote unquote extended school year, which is basically our 9-month calendar that ends in May or June, depending on your state. But what we've come to know since then is that ultimately it's the early experience that is the smoking gun for both education success and long-term health. And as state legislators, of course, familiar with the budget, you know that these are the two buckets where you spend the most money education and health. And when you peel all of the issues of education and health back, you arrive at those earliest years of a child's life. Because the things that happen to you early in life leave biological memories in your body, not cognitive memories, but biological memories, because what happens to you early in life literally gets under your skin. And that's what is going to help determine your long-term education success and ultimately your long-term health. Now, in today's short time that I have, I won't really be able to get as much into the health side, and obviously we'll focus on the education side. So I want to start with the brain. We've all heard a lot about the brain in the last 10, 15, 20 years, and talking about the size of the brain and that the brain is, you know, 85% grown by the time the child's three, or 95% by the time the child's age five. And that's all critically important, of course, but of course, that's just talking about the mass of the brain. What's more important is how each of the areas of the brain are developing. And so there's really seven major stages of brain development. And they're all listed here, and they all begin prenatally. And those first four on the page are completely done by the time the child's born, if it's a full-term pregnancy. And so when we talk about early childhood after the birth, we're really talking about those last three. And the two most impactful for this conversation that I want to highlight are really the number
five.
Sorry
to jump in, but I think maybe the slide hasn't changed.
It hasn't? You don't have a brain architecture slide in front of you?
No.
Okay, so what I'm
going to do. Or I don't, unless something's really weird with me. And I'm sorry, this is Representative Lloyd Pryor. I'm not on screen, but good to see you again.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to stop sharing and then relaunch it. And sometimes that does the trick in my experience. So let me get back there. Do you see the brain architecture image now?
Now we have a black screen that says that you have started screen sharing, but there's no image beyond that.
Wow, super frustrating. I'm going to try that again. This would be quite difficult to continue. Any luck now?
Same thing as the last time, I'm afraid.
Okay, let me try to advance this one. Anything now?
No, sir.
Oof, this is terrible.
And Ms. Burt, I think we had the slides sent out us ahead of time. So possibly one of us can do the slides.
Yep, I'm just pulling them up. One moment.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you, Representative Pryor.
Yeah, so I'm going to stop sharing, and that would allow, of course, Sarah to be able to do it. My apologies. Don't know why that's not working.
We very much empathize and just appreciate that, you know, it always seems like there's a good workaround available. And it's just a nice pause.
Yeah, and I guess if worse comes to worse, if you all received the slides, I can just kind of walk you through while you look at the slides without all my beautiful animations.
Sure, do that and I'll catch up.
Okay, well, let's see. I will be able to track it here. So we are on slide 4, entitled Brain Architecture, and you'll see an image of a developing brain in a young child's body. And you see I have highlighted there cell connections and synaptic pruning, and that's really what we're trying to influence during this early childhood period, because that's the most important piece of the puzzle here. Children are born with all of the cells they're going to have in their brain, and then the key isn't just that the cells exist, but that they connect. And then you don't want to have too many connections, because it's really like an overgrown garden. You want to prune that down so that you have the right connections. So on slide 5, if you see a slide there called synapse formation, you'll see down at birth, it's just a little image of the cells, and that you see by 2 years of old, 2 years of age, they get to be connected up. There's a lot of clutter there because you'll actually have more cell connections at the age of two than you'll ever have in your entire life. during between the months of 3 and 15 months of age, you have about 40,000 connections being made every second of life. So you have more than 900 trillion connections at that point in life. But then, just like I was saying, the most beautiful garden is not the one that has the biggest, bushiest garden, but you want to nurture it and prune it down. And the way the brain does that is based on experience. What you use, you keep, and what you don't use, you're going to prune away, because you basically don't want to be encumbered with too many connections. That's actually a whole different disorder that people struggle with. So on slide 6, you see that what we're pointing out, that the brain changes its structure and function in response to experience. Right, we want to nurture and stimulate our young children because that leads to very positive development of the brain. But the absence of those nurturance and stimulation, thank you, the absence of that nurturance or stimulation isn't just missing out, but actually can harm. Negative experiences harm the developing brain. So a fearful, scary, stressful series of events, it can be very damaging to the brain and how it's going to develop. So the best example I can give you in terms of how experience dependent the brain is if you just think of language. And when a baby's born, what language can the baby speak? And the answer is it can speak any language ever known to mankind. But the language or languages that the baby will speak ultimately are the languages they experience. Right, so you see there that the capacity to speak multiple languages is very dependent upon the experiences of the young child. You can still learn it later in life, but it's much easier if you learn it early in life because your brain is adapting to learning multiple languages. So if you go to slide 7, I want to turn to some of the, you know, what would be a negative experience. And, you know, we know that keeping toxic chemicals and any kind of toxic insults away from our children is critically important. And so we worked for years to get lead and mercury away from our children. But on the next slide, you see what we're talking about, and I'm sure you've heard a lot about, is toxic stress. And stress, even though it's hard for us to conceive of that for our youngest children, what do young babies have to be stressed out about? But, you know, a young child, a baby is born and they come out very stressed out. They come out crying and screaming really at the top of their lungs. They're very disoriented, they're in a new space, they're experiencing light for the very first time, and hopefully the adults in their life respond to them and soothe them and swaddle them and help them calm down. And on the next slide, you see that we call that or refer to that as tolerable stress. So your kind of stress response system is alerted, it goes off, but then the adults in that child's life help them get back to a more relaxed state. But on the next slide, when you talk about toxic stress, you see we're really alluding to, you know, one stressful event after another, after another, after another. So if you're growing up in an impoverished home, a home with physical or emotional abuse, chronic neglect, mental health issues in the home, substance abuse in the home, family or community violence, or unfortunately many of these things come together, that child is probably experiencing one stressor after another. And those stressors are inhibiting the adults in that child's life from being able to respond appropriately and care for the child. And so you really have this chronic alarm being sent off inside the child. And if you go to the next slide, that you really think about what happens to you as an adult when your stress response system goes off, right? Because it's a very involuntary response when you get stressed out or nervous about something. Your heart rate may go up, your blood pressure may rise, your respirations increase, your palms may sweat, you may get butterflies in your stomach. All of those things happen automatically, involuntarily. Your system is being activated to help you deal with the stress. And that's a survival instinct, and that's good. It helps you deal with stressful situations. But on the next slide, you see that, you know, what happens in the stress response system, you secrete a chemical called cortisol, which is the first stage of the stress response. And when you do that to help you respond to the stress, there's a trade-off. So you're diverting resources internally, and you're taking resources from your immune system to deal with the stress. And that's why if you have a chronic health condition, you know from your doctor that one of the first things you need to do to manage that chronic condition is reduce the stress in your life. Or if you're very stressed out about remembering something, you know, how good are you at remembering the thing that you're stressed out about having to remember? And certainly if you're stressed, it's hard to pay attention and it creates very anxious behavior. So as an adult, we can certainly, you know, understand all of that, but the same thing happens for a young child. And we hope for a young child, you have other resources to help you deal with the stress. But in the absence of that, with your alarm system just going off, we see very elevated levels of cortisol in young children. And so sometimes we misinterpret behavior of young kids in early education settings as overactive, overreactive, hyperactive. But in actuality, they just have a very activated stress response system, and they perceive things as more frightening and scary, and they're kind of on edge. And so we as adults have to understand that this is not conscious decisions to be difficult, that they're just responding to a very stressful life experience up until that point. Now on the next slide, you see an image of the brain architecture. And what you see are the areas of the brain that are circled there that are activated when you're anxious or fearful. And what happens is the cortisol goes to those areas to help you respond to the stressful situation. But on the next slide, you see the areas of the brain that you activate to deal with memory or learning. And what you see is those are the exact same areas. So if you're a child in an education setting and you're dealing with anxiety or fear, you literally can't do both, be anxious and fearful and be learning and remembering the lessons or directions that are being given to you. These things are incompatible. And it's why we have to be much more in tune with how our children are really feeling and what their experiences are. So it's much bigger than just education. We have to make sure our children are ready to learn, which means they feel safe and secure. Now I want to turn to schools on the next slide and really talk about successful schools, because we've heard for years that disparities or gaps in schools and educational achievement exist because of the school. But the reality is, and this is the most important part of the presentation, is that disparities exist not because of the schools, but because of what happens or hasn't happened before a child ever enters school. Yet those disparities exist before kindergarten, and for many children, those disparities begin to emerge as early as 2 years of age. Now, what I want to show you starting on the next slide is some results from data that come out of Stanford, which in this era of big data has looked at over 300 million test records in all the middle school, public middle schools in the country from third through eighth grade, 11,000 school districts. And they've been able to map out every single school district, and I'll show you how to get it for any districts that you represent. But basically what I'm going to show you is some examples on this slide, and the dotted line you see on this slide from third grade through eighth grade, the grade level being on the horizontal x-axis and your grade level achievement on the y-axis. So you see it there on the far left. If you're in third grade, we hope that all the children are at the third grade level. And at the fourth grade level, and moving on up till eighth grade and obviously eighth grade level. So if you're above this dotted line, you're doing better than your grade level expectation. And if you're below the line, you're behind your grade level expectation. So if we go to the next slide, I pick on my community here in Evanston, Illinois. And you see the children here in Evanston from third through eighth grade are consistently above grade level expectation. At third grade, they're about the fourth grade level. By eighth grade, they're at the 10th grade level. Looks like a really good story for the community to celebrate. But on the next slide, you see if we break it down by socioeconomic status, you see the lower income students are below that dotted line at third grade. By eighth grade, they're almost up to that dotted line, but still not there. And on the next slide, you'll see what that compares to the quote unquote non-poor students. And you see the non-poor students are substantially above grade level at third grade all the way through 12th grade. But what you see, the gap between third grade poor kids and non-poor kids and eighth grade, the poor kids and the non-poor kids, the gap really hasn't increased. Not only that, the gap hasn't decreased. It has a smidgen. So the question that this chart really calls out to you is, was the achievement gap the problem of the school, or was the achievement gap the problem that occurred before the kids ever even entered third grade? Because if you remember back to your favorite algebra class and learning about the slope of a line, you see the slopes of these two lines are the same. They're not getting wider. The schools aren't exacerbating the achievement gap, but they haven't been able to close the achievement gap either. But remember, the schools designed by Horace Mann in 1850 were designed to educate kids 1 year at a time. And if you're doing that at grade level, the schools are being successful. Obviously, we'd love for them to do more, but to expect them to close a gap that is so big at third grade and really by kindergarten is really beyond the expectation. And I'll give you an extreme example here on the next slide, which is the Chicago Public Schools, you know, third largest urban school district in the country, kind of infamous for poor success with their students. At third grade, you see them well behind third grade level. They're around second grade level. By eighth grade, they're almost caught up. So the success story here is, you know, unfortunately, kids still are not at grade level, but Chicago Public Schools actually had 6 years of growth in 5 years, which made it the most successful large public school district in the country, gaining 1.2 years per year for each of those 5 years to get a full year of extra growth in 5 years. That is so difficult to do that getting one full year over that 5 year span made it the most successful large school district in the entire United States. So looking at the next slide, again, still using this data from Stanford, basically what you see here on that red line is if a school is above that red line, you're getting more than 1 year of growth per year. If you're below that red line, you're getting less than 1 year of growth per year. And on average, the schools in the United States are getting 1 year of growth per year. Now, half are above it and half are below it. So on the next slide, you see what it would take if you got 1.1 years of growth. If you got just that little smidgens more for your school district, 1.1 year of growth each year, you would be in the top 20% of all districts in the United States. So that's how hard that is to do. And on the next slide, if you got that 1.2 years of growth, which would give you 6 years and 5 years, you would be in the top 3% in the country. So that's how extremely difficult this is. To get 1.2 years of growth per year in your school on average would make you a top 3% district in the entire United States. So let's apply that now, starting on the next slide, to Illinois. Illinois has a goal of having 90% of the kids proficient starting high school in ninth grade, and it's currently at 36%. To get toward that goal, I want to show you how astronomical the growth would have to be starting in third grade. So at the next slide, you see that if you got to the 58th percent level, where 58% of the kids were proficient by ninth grade, would require that all the schools in your entire state would have to get 1.2 years of growth per year through third grade through eighth grade. And that would mean that every district in the entire state is in the top 3% in the country. On the next slide, you see just to get to 77%, you'd have to get 7 years of growth in the 5 years, and you still wouldn't be at the state's goal of 90%. And finally, on the next slide, to actually reach your goal of 90% of the kids proficient, you would have to get 8 years in 5 years. And again, there's no school district in the entire country, let alone an entire state, that is doing that. So if we want to have our kids proficient at high school, we can't start to fix the achievement gap in school. We have to prevent the achievement gap from ever emerging, because the schools alone are not going to be able to close the gap. The gaps exist not because of the school, they exist because of what happened before the kids ever got to school. Now on the next slide, you'll see some resources that is how we got to the conclusions I just showed you. And that website there that's listed will get you to a site that you can put in any school district in the country and see exactly how you're doing on all of these measures. And you can compare different districts in your state or anywhere else in the country. So I encourage you to look at those districts. So now getting back to our father of American public education, 1850, he created our system. And obviously the system has created a great deal, and we know, I mean, the knowledge has grown a great deal since that time in 1850. And so on the next slide, just to highlight some of the innovations that have happened in the country in education, as we've gone from the one room schoolhouse to, you know, big, beautiful high schools and everything, in 1946, we started giving school lunch to low-income children. In 1954, we desegregated the schools. In 1965, we started giving low-income communities more federal dollars for education. In 1975, we started serving children with special needs. In 1990, we revised the way we serve children with special needs. In 2002, we started testing the heck out of our children. And in 2015, we revised the way we test the heck out of our kids. But on the next slide, you see that the big question we all have to deal with today, and certainly, you know, people like you in the leadership positions that you're in, is if you were building the system today, would you start at age 5? And I think the answer is obvious, that there's no way you would start at age 5 knowing what we know today. And so we're left with this system that we're trying to jerry-rig to start sort of serving our kids before they ever get to school, but we have to do more. And so if you look at the next slide, a summary of some of the policy and program opportunities you may hear about, from home visiting to universal pre-K, the issues around quality versus quantity, pay parity issues, infant mental health services, paid parental leave. And I have a box there because it's all of the above. No one of these alone is going to shift the curve to prevent the disparities that exist before children ever enter school. So on the next slide to close, it's really a question of investing in early experience, not just early education. And we need to build from prenatal to birth up, not just from K-12 down. And so I would like, you know, on the next slide, just to remind us that those first 3 years of life, from birth until the age of 3, it's only 1,100 days. It's a very short period of time. But the reality is we can't expect parents to just do this alone. We have to acknowledge the systems and structures that have excluded people from the resources and experiences that limit their children's potential, the foundation of that potential being the first 1,100 days. And in an era now of equity and equal opportunity, that starts the day you are born, really prenatally. And so we really do have to get this right at the beginning when we think about fixing our education system. So with that, I thank you. Again, I apologize for the technical difficulties, and I hope we have a few minutes for any questions that people may have. Thank you very much.
Dr. Nagel, thank you very much for that. You may be interested to know that Representative Richardson has carried some legislation this year regarding Black maternal health, and issues that go right to your last comments there about needing to start prenatally.
That's excellent.
Members, questions for Dr. Nagel? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, at the end of the presentation you did, you know, you talked about equity and those opportunities in terms of equity. And if we're talking about, racism as a public health crisis, do you have anything particular to say about how these early childhood experiences, these first 1,100 days, and how that this disparities that we might be seeing in terms of, you know, our communities of color versus the rest of, particularly in Minnesota, if you have any data about that or any insights that you can give us.
Dr. Nagel.
Yes, well, thank you for the question. And, you know, I think it is the most important question as we talk about all of these issues. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of federal money that is coming to the states to figure out how to support these systems. And, you know, the biggest thing we have to think about is how these systems do not just get allocated with equity in mind, but also that that equity has to understand that we have to overcome the inequities that have created these disparities, right? The data that I'm sure you've seen over time about the racial disparities in educational achievement, there's nothing about race that would determine that people should have different educational outcomes. The educational outcomes, the disparity in educational outcomes exists solely as a result of a system that created inequities that led to those outcomes. There's nothing inherently different about people that would lead to that, and certainly not based on their skin color. So we need to keep that front and center, that these disparities exist not by accident. I'm not saying they're on purpose or deliberate from people, but the system created the outcomes that the system was designed to achieve. And so we have to be smarter and better. And we obviously are not happy with the outcomes the system is producing. So we have to produce a better system to produce better outcomes. So as we allocate these resources, I just think that needs to be the beacon in front of us. And we need to not point fingers at people, but point fingers at the system and acknowledge the system has done what it was designed to do. And therefore, we have to design a much smarter, better system that is going to overcome these structural inequities. So just putting more high quality early childcare services in a low-income community without ensuring that there's appropriate access to those through transportation, the hours that are available, et cetera, isn't going to really get you there. So we really have to make sure that our lens is well focused on that issue as we try to overcome the many generations of the inequities that have produced the results that we're all fighting to overcome now.
Representative Pryor, any follow-up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation, Doctor, and certainly trauma will have an impact on children and adults as well. So thank you for the information. I have a question. How do you account, though, for so many people having suffered through trauma and tough times, but having achieved in the end? I mean, I could name many off the top of my head, but I'll refer to a case, kind of a real life case issue. Dr. Benjamin Chavis went out to California. He's a superintendent, a PhD, obviously, Native American, African-American roots from Carolina, rose up and became a prominent leader. He took on a challenge out in California, charter schools, the first one you might be familiar with. He took on a Native American charter school, and he had, the short story is, a lot of problems and challenges in the community, a poor community, at-risk children, trauma, all those things that you can imagine. And this particular school was at the bottom 5% performing in the state of California. When he was done, it was in the top 5% performing in the state. And he did that with three other schools. A fifth one, they didn't buy into his plan, so he let it go. So you don't have to answer, but there are these examples out there all over the place, and he did it. 60 Minutes did a story on him. He wrote a book about it, which, of course, I read. So I'm not disputing the role that trauma plays, but certainly he took on these schools. And, of course, there are examples of that sort of success in many private schools, public schools and private schools, public and private alike, have had success working through these issues and getting the children educated. But I will end with this. I do find your declarative statement that the system is not, it is the system, I do agree. And that's what I struggle with all the time, not funding systems. But it seems to be a fairly strong declarative statement that that within that, that the others bear no responsibility, the politicians and bureaucrats and administrators. bear no responsibility for these policies and all stuff is done. Finally, and I'll shut up, is we know, for example, that literacy, if you're not teaching it right, the kids aren't reading and learning. So you create a disparity. Mississippi is living proof of how you can do that. They are beating Minnesota in many categories of reading for their children. So Mississippi is living proof of it. They've changed in teaching their kids to read. If they're not learning to read, they can't succeed. And if you're teaching the wrong way, they're not going to succeed. I'm not blaming the educators. They didn't get what they were supposed to get out of college. You're probably familiar with the reading war. So I'll wrap up by saying I don't disagree with the trauma. Thank you for the presentation. But I see this other stuff out there, and I still have to question, well, how did they get it to work? And why is Mississippi succeeding? And there has to be some, there's other things in there as well. I don't think it's as simple as just saying it's just 100% trauma outside the classroom. But thank you for the presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And would you like me to respond to that, Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Chair Chamberlain. Dr. Nagel, please. There was a lot there.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in your response.
There was a lot there. And thank you, Senator Chamberlain. You raised and put on the table many, many, many good points there. I'm going to just take a few of those because that would be take me much longer to have a very interesting conversation, I hope, with you one day about all that. I certainly wasn't saying that this is all about trauma. I was just giving an example that for a lot of children, they're growing up in very stressful environments. And some get to certainly the point of trauma and some may not. The number one ingredient to helping a child, any individual, get overcome trauma is relationships. And especially, you know, if you're young, how does a young child experience the world? They experience the world through the relationships they have with their adult caretakers. Parents, two parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, childcare teachers, whoever that may be. So at the core of everything that happens in from an early childhood perspective, is relationship. And anytime you're evaluating, as you hear about programs that are successful, you can look to the core, which is where are the relationships between the adults and the children? How do we nurture that? How do we support the adults who may be coming from the same challenging communities? How do we support them so that they can be everything to the child that the child needs? And for most individuals who have overcome incredibly challenging starts to life, you will, if you talk to them, you will find that they were able to do it because of a key critical adult in their life who believed in them and supported them and helped them overcome through the most difficult times. Now, you raised a lot of, or a couple examples of people who have been able to take really struggling school districts and do Herculean work to turn them around. And those exceptions exist, and they're very few and far between, because they really do take a almost supernatural ability to overcome the many, many obstacles. And they're able to do it through their force of will and the systems and structures they set up to overcome the many challenges for that community, which start with the support of people from a very emotional point of view. People need to feel secure and safe in order to grow and learn and thrive. That is like an essential ingredient for all of us. And if we think back to how did we become the people that we are, it's because of the adults that we had in our life guiding us, the good and the bad and whatever. But when you think about that American adage of pick yourself up by your bootstraps, which started as a very different phrase, which started about the futility of trying to do something like that and turned into this ideal of anyone can uplift themselves. But behind almost all of those success stories of people who did overcome amazingly difficult odds are people who will quickly tell you, well, there was my great uncle or my grandfather or my mother who just persevered and taught me how to do that. And so that's usually behind the story. And it often doesn't get picked up as much. And we marvel at people who have overcome, you know, coming from deep deprivation to succeed, which is fantastic. But you know, overall, you're right. You know, none of this is about dooming people. There are exceptions. But if we're talking about the big picture here, public health was mentioned, right? We're talking about population. And you look at measures of outcomes for whole communities, whole school districts, whole states. you got to look much more down the middle, and we can't expect 75 superintendents to turn around every district in the state. We have to build better systems that allow really good, smart people to flourish in those systems and build successful pathways for our children. So it's much more difficult than the 20 minutes I had to outline it. It's not as simple as just pointing a finger at trauma, but it does root back. And again, there's a whole nother side of this, which is long-term health outcomes. It all roots back to what's happening for the person early in their life. And trauma early in life, there's a direct link and a biological cause for all of the major diseases in the United States being caused earlier if you've had trauma in your life.
Dr. Chamberlain? All right, thank you. Dr. Nagel, one question from me, which is you rightly and persuasively focus on early childhood and the roots there, but I've seen research in the past that looked at what's usually termed the summer learning loss and the cumulative impact of differences in enrichment opportunities, summer camps, going to museums, traveling as a family and the like, between lower income individuals and middle and upper income individuals. And the argument being that the cumulative impact of this little bit of slide that students may experience over the summer goes a long way to explaining the gaps that we see in achievement. Can you just respond to that? Because it seems to fit with the Stanford data, but yeah, you didn't draw it out in the Stanford data.
Yeah, and that other book that was referenced on that slide there, which is by a sociologist at Ohio State University who looked at all of this. And the conclusion really is that, again, it's what happens outside of the school, so that the schools will educate the kids by and large at the same rate. What happens is, what was the experiences of the child before they got to school? And then what are the experiences of the child when they're out of school time, be it in the summer or even, you know, when school lets out at 3 or 3:30 or whatever? Because a child's only in school a small percentage of the number of hours of the year. I think it's around 20% or something. So what we see in the summers isn't a slide for one group and a maintenance for another. It's really a continued growth for one group and a stable, for the other. So one group of children is having really positive, nurturing, stimulating experiences out of school time. And another group of children, unfortunately, doesn't have access to the same number of weeks of camp, or maybe a sleepaway camp, or a travel experience with their family, or enrichment activities, or more, out of school time organized activities. So again, we have to think of it as a broader thing than just education. It's about the experiences. And again, if you think in your life, what have you learned the most from? It's your experiences. And, school is one experience you have, but your out of school time are a whole nother set of experiences. And all of those experiences have a tremendous impact in shaping who you are, helping you learn and helping you grow, and be that in a healthy way or a less than optimal way. The food and nutrition that you have access to, the health support systems that are out there, access to pediatricians in a timely manner, all of these things impact us in many different ways. And children don't just grow in terms of a cognitive function in a way of literacy and cognition. We grow socially, we grow emotionally, we grow physically. All of these things grow together. And in some areas, we take two steps forward while one area goes back, and then the other area goes two steps forward and one goes back. But it's all connected. And so we have to think of the whole child, which gets us connected to the whole family. And that's been why the successful home visiting programs have been so important, because they help build the relationship, not just between the home visitor and the family, but then that home visitor is supporting the parent to build a successful relationship with their child. And that is going to be what helps that child when they do get into stressful situations, which everyone's going to experience. How do they learn how to cope and deal with that and get back to a more calm state so they can deal with whatever the many things they have to deal with, including learning in school?
Thank you very much. Senator Wieger, then we'll wrap up, members. Senator Wieger, you're muted.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Dr. Nagel. I'm all for what you presented, and you know the question does come up on resources and how we prioritize. And a lot of times, as we discuss resources, there is the discussion with business. We are preparing a future workforce in addition to the participating as citizens. But could you talk about successful partnerships you helped encourage in forwarding your message, and specific examples in parts of the country? And then, somewhat unrelated, but I think I saw on your resume that you were in Los Angeles for several years in the film industry. And how might this tie in with messaging and what you're doing? Thank you.
Dr. Nagel.
Well, thank you for that question. Thank you for digging up my resume somewhere. Yes, my first career, if you will, the first 8 or 10 years or so was in the film industry, because as a young idealistic, 22 after college, I went out to Los Angeles because, I thought the way you change the world and make it a better, more fair place was to, do that through film and television. And obviously that's not necessarily how it goes. And certainly that industry is not about changing the world. It's a business, it's show business, and it wants to make money. So after doing that for a number of years, I realized I wasn't going to change the world or help anybody through my little efforts out there, and I was really only helping myself. So I shifted gears and looked for a way to be more directly serving children and families. So I don't know how the two can intersect, other than every once in a while, there is a film that raises social consciousness about an issue to the segment of people who obviously, care about films or those types of TV shows. In terms of the national conversation or in any states about building a movement and connections, there's a lot going on in the country, obviously, about young children. And now we see on the federal level a push, at least by some, to really start pushing a lot of money and resources to young children and families. And we'll see where that goes. For a lot of states, the way the conversation has hooked in is around pre-K. And so we certainly celebrate that people are paying attention more to the needs of young children. But in some ways, the pre-K conversation has kidnapped the larger picture here. Because if all we do is get our state or community pre-K, that's a step in the right direction. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. And so then we'll do that and we'll wait 20 years and we'll still all be frustrated that we're still getting these disparities, because we have to do more than just move a K-12 system down to a pre-K-12 system. We have to conceive of something from birth up, not from K-12 down. And again, the only reason we're in a framework of K-12 is that when this was originally conceived in 1850, we thought what happened for a young child didn't matter because they didn't remember it. And so we get a freebie for the first 5 years. Wait till them become five, we'll put them in school, and we'll start to educate our kids. We know that now that's a very different picture of the way people develop. And again, while you may not have the cognitive memories from being 2 and 3, biologically, you do have those memories. And what happens to you in those first years of life is going to have impacts on you physiologically and biologically that are going to impact you later in life. And so if we're building the system today with what we know, we would not be waiting to 5 to start. You would never start to build anything with like the end product and then moving forward. You would start at the beginning, build a strong foundation and go up from there. And certainly we do it with our homes. And if we don't, we have trouble with the homes. We're struggling with human capital in our country. We're not making the investments up front to build the foundation that we need. And so that's really what needs to happen in the conversation. It's not just about fixing the education system. It's not about making the education system serve our young children. It's about building a system to serve our young children and families until they're ready to go into the education system.
Anything more, Senator Wieger?
Yes, it's definitely a challenge. And with some of your colleagues, for example, I believe your predecessor went to the Buffett foundation. You know, there's a lot of resources that can help in transforming systems, and it's key to be working with the business community to have the successful model. So we'll continue to work on that challenge because it really is a win-win. Thank you.
You're absolutely right. And there's been a lot of efforts to get the business community connected. And I think we all struggle with that. And you see now, because of the pandemic, a lot more people are aware that these issues and the high quality childcare really impact families, which then means how many people are available to work and be in the workforce and all of those issues. People are starting to get how connected this is to every piece of our social fabric. So it's a great point you're making.
Dr. Nagel, I failed to see out of the corner of my eye, my colleague, Representative Hassan's hand was up. So if you can handle one last question and then we'll wrap. Representative Hassan, my apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, no problem. Thank you for this great presentation. I agree with everything that you said, that early childhood experience is important. As someone who is a mental health clinician, I concur with this. But sometimes what I struggle with is a parent can do everything in their power to make sure that their children have pleasant and joyful early childhood experience. But I struggle how race plays factor in this, because you're sending your child to a system that's inherently racist, that was never meant for them. If you are a Black, Brown, or Indigenous parent, so as important as early childhood is, it's also, I missed, but it's also important to acknowledge that race plays a huge factor in the issues that we're seeing in our education system. And I don't wanna like play down that this is early childhood is important. I am a firm believer that, you know, maternal health is important. You know, early childhood is important. All these pieces add up. But at the end of the day, it comes down to the factor of race, and that our, you know, PIPOC students do not fit into this system. They go into a system that devalues them, that doesn't see them as equal to their white counterparts, that was never meant for them or was never designed to educate them. So I don't know if, I mean, you don't have to say anything about it, but I just missed the part where race is factored into this. If you have something to say about that, that's fine, but I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hassan. Dr. Nagel, you can respond, but any closing comments as well, please.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't disagree with anything that was just raised. I think that, again, it's not about a child being any specific race. I agree with what you're saying, though. It's a system. And was, you know, who was the system built for? How was it designed? How is it designed to support people, all people or not? And if it's not, how do we change that and adapt? Is it different systems? Is it one system? I mean, that's for, you know, people in positions like all of you are in to make those determinations. I think where we're agreeing is I'm saying it is about the system. There's nothing inherent based on a person's skin color that would make that child succeed or fail, other than they have to grow up in the systems that we've created here. And so I think we're basically agreeing. And so the challenge ultimately is, how do we design the system that we want, that is equitable, that is going to support all children and families? And that's really, I think, the grand challenge for today. And I would maintain that whatever we decide, it has to start with a strong, supportive, positive system for all children and all families. And to do that isn't just about building an equal system. We have to build an equitable system, which means we have to realize that not everyone was given the same fair shake before they even got here, and that we have to compensate for that as well as we design these systems.
Dr. Nagel, thank you very much. You've been so generous with your time and your insights, and we appreciate it.
Well, thank you all for having me. Great to see everyone, and take care.
You as well.
Bye-bye.
Members, next up is Dr. Bernadia Johnson, former teacher, former administrator, former superintendent, and now professor. So Professor Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed. Your focus is going to be on discipline today, as I understand it.
Yes, it is. Thank you. It's good to see everyone. My name is Dr. Bernadia Johnson, and I'm a former superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, as well as former deputy superintendent of Memphis City Schools. I'm currently an assistant professor at Minnesota State University Mankato, and I have the pleasure of serving on local and national committees and organizations that see education as a public good. I'm a mother and I'm a grandmother, and these issues are so important to me. I want to thank Dr. Nagel for his presentation. Certainly, he paved the way for my presentation. I've been here before you during this current legislative session and years prior, talking about disparities in discipline. And in past presentations, I've talked about implicit bias that we hold towards students of color and how they manifest itself into harsher disciplinary practices towards students of color. And today I'm not gonna dive deeply into the data because I've done that and I can send that information to you. Today I wanna talk about more about what we can do now in this time and moving forward. But I would like to share just a little data with you. So on the national average, Black youth are 3.5 times more likely to be suspended or expelled than their white peers. In Minnesota, they're 8 times more likely to be expelled or suspended. And on a national average, Native youth are 5 times more likely to be suspended or expelled than their white peers. In Minnesota, they're 10 times more likely to be dismissed than their white peers. And so, like I said, today I want to build off the talk about how this should alarm all of us as Minnesotans, because a lot is at stake for us in this state. And I'd also like to talk about meaningful solutions, some of which are captured in the House and Senate omnibus bills. So the pandemic and the school, as we know it, has been completely upended. We're in a state of rebuilding and addressing inequities that existed well before the pandemic, but have only been magnified and exacerbated by it. And we cannot afford to rebuild back to the way things were, as we just heard. Why? Because the way things were not working for all of our students, especially our BIPOC students. We cannot use ARP funding for great tutoring without addressing who fundamentally has access to high quality academic programming. And that is why we must continue to look at our discipline practices and the extent to which they exclude students, some at much higher rates. The time is now to make schools inclusive spaces for all students so they can be successful. Some may think, and I'm not naive, I know some people may think that this is only an urban issue, but this impacts every corner of our state. For example, when the Minnesota Department of Human Rights entered into agreements with school districts having atrocious racial disparities, there were districts of all sizes from across the states, and including Cloquet, Cache Lake, Bemidji, Wilmer, Winona, yes, and indeed, Minneapolis and St. Paul. I've also learned more about the statewide experiences as a professor at Minnesota State University Mankato, and I've come to the conclusion that we all are dealing with these complexities at some level or another. And I know that my students from outside the Twin City area are very much recognizing that Minneapolis and St. Paul has served as a canary in the mine, and that the things that the inner cities have addressed and dealt with for years are now surfacing in their communities. It is clear that it is important in impacting all of us. We all lose when schools are not inclusive, safe spaces for all students to make mistakes, learn, and to grow and feel safe. And I'm not gonna be teaching here, but the fact of the matter is, you ever get a chance to read The Cycle of Socialization by Harbaugh, it talks about how our environments are shaped by our interactions with systems and with people. And that's really important. So, and I could talk about that as a parent myself. What I shared and did for my own children and what happened when they were faced with systems that were inequitable and or racist. So this impacts not only students who are unfairly pushed out, but their classmates as well, who receive the message that it is not a cohesive community where we work together in right wrongs, but a place where we turn away students who are compliant all the time. And it starts to surface in other ways. I don't have to bring up what happened in just recently in White Bear Lake and the other lake, I can't remember it now, but my grandson lives in that community. So I'm absolutely concerned about his education and the environment that he'll be in and what people think about people with the melanin, with melanin in their skin. So we need bold action. The House Omnibus Bills takes important steps in the right direction. Third grade suspension ban. This bill bans the use of suspensions. And I would say we also had expulsions for our youngest learners through third grade. Something I did for Minneapolis when I was superintendent, it can and should be done statewide. And I started out with looking at nonviolent behavior, requiring non-exclusionary discipline prior to discipline. It requires adults to use practices that support first instead of quickly, that support the students first instead of quickly reporting, resorting to suspensions. Something I saw more from some than others, showing that it's possible to use suspensions rarely if we put in strategies that we can use and deploy before suspensions. And I don't know about you, but suspensions don't change behaviors. And I will tell you, I was deputy superintendent in Memphis, and this is surfacing recently. We had corporal punishment where students were paddled. The same 7,000 Black boys in Memphis City schools were paddled over four times. So it's 28,000 paddlings, and it just never changed behavior. So we have to do something different. We have to have better documentation of pupil withdrawal agreements. This bill will require aggregate reports on pupil withdrawal agreements to give us a better picture of who has been subject to these near expulsions. And one of the practices that I put in place that I would suggest people look at is I review suspensions with my academic team every month. We read every suspension. We read, looked at every category the student was in, whether EBD, special ed. And I will tell you that the majority of the suspensions I had when I was in Minneapolis Public Schools actually were special ed students who get a lot of resources and support. You know, the class size is small and everything. So we have to expand services and support and invest in teachers of color as well. There are also a number of provisions that will also impact discipline indirectly. Talking about the conversation before, there are a lot of things that are consequential to the work in school districts that we need to understand. So for example, provisions that expand social and emotional support for students is necessary. Investments in diversifying the teacher force is also critical. Students who see people that look like them and who understand them excel and do better in school. I would encourage the Senate and the House to continue to build off this work in the years to come by both continuing to limit some types of exclusionary practices. Bottom line, there are some things we just shouldn't do anywhere in Minnesota, like suspending first graders. And I'm sure you all remember the lip gloss story of the kindergarten student who was suspended for 3 days for putting on lip gloss. I would also like this body to continue to invest in solutions such as restorative justice programming and other more program implemented based on the policies that we're using. And in closing, simply put, if students aren't in school, they aren't learning. Any conversation about the opportunity gap must include access to learning environments. Any conversation about rebuilding our educational system must include conversations about non-exclusionary discipline. When we know better, we do better, and we know better, Minnesota, so we must do better. But I do have an editorial piece that I want to also add. We have to stop this thing around exceptionalism. We think, why can't we learn from other people? Because we think we're exceptional. We already know what we need to know. If we don't respond very well, by we, and I'm including myself in this, Minnesotans, you know, we have the Lake Wobegon effect. We're beautiful, we're smart, we know everything. We're smarter than everybody else. And the fact of the matter is, that's not true. As evidenced by, I think it was Mr. Chamberlain who brought the fact that Mississippi has better reading scores. I mean, I'm from Alabama, and I never thought that I would see the day where Minnesota, my beloved Minnesota, where I moved and wanted to be here, would be at the bottom of the list in disparities. Thank you for your time and attention to this matter. It really is important.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Members, questions? Seeing none, Professor Johnson, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And so when I don't hear questions, that means everybody understands what I'm saying and they know what their charge is. So I'm going to take the silence as you're acting on what I said. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time today. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
Members, before we pivot to reviewing the spreadsheets for the committee, I think I'll take a page from Chair Chamberlain's book yesterday and give everybody a five-minute break, get up, move around a little bit, and that would put us back, let's say, 2:25. We'll stretch it out as far as 8 minutes. So we see everyone back at 2:25. Thank you. Thank you for that break. Members, Chair Chamberlain, we've wanted to point out that we've been joined today by Commissioner Mueller and some members of her team. Commissioner, thank you for joining us and taking the time out of your schedule. I don't know if you have any comments that you want to make, but please take a moment.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. Chair Daphne, Chair Chamberlain, committee.
And Commissioner, we cannot hear you. Oh, I cannot hear you.
Can anybody else hear me?
I hear you.
Okay, that makes me feel a little better.
I'm sure you were great.
Genius is what just happened there. I just wanted to say, you know, good afternoon, everybody. You know, Chair Daphne, Chair Chamberlain, conference committee members. As you know, I'm Commissioner of the Education. My name is Heather Mueller, and I want to just take this opportunity to participate and thank you for allowing me to do so and acknowledge the important work in front of us. I also want to thank you for your time and your commitment throughout this session that you have had on behalf of our students, our families, our educators, our schools, and our communities, especially as we are navigating through this COVID-19 pandemic and these really important issues that are underlying our work. As I've said before, and I think I want to make sure that I reiterate this at every instance, I do believe that we all are on do our work in education. My commitment to this work has been for over 25 years and has been my profession and my passion. And for those of you who are on the Education Committee and serving on this conference committee, it also is just acknowledged that this is like your area and that you come at this from the perspective of really wanting to set our students. And although we may have areas where we agree or disagree, it gives us the at least a grounding in that we are coming at this or really thinking about the best interests of our students and our roles in providing resources and guidance and tools for our students and educators and families. I know that we can collaborate in putting forward a strong package that really places a strong value on equity and that supports our most underserved students. And it really helps us demonstrate a commitment, you know, by our state to our ongoing resources to ensure that we have all of the pieces that we need to come out of this pandemic stronger, to come out better, to build the systems and structures that we need, and a system that really is for each and every student every single day. We can't miss the opportunity that's in front of us to really make a difference in what education looks like from birth through adult for each and every student that we have in our schools, in our adult basic education programs, and in our early learning programs. And so I just want you to know that my team and I are committed to continuing to partner with all of you. We're looking forward to being able to provide any technical assistance or support throughout this process. And we just really appreciate your ongoing collaboration, not only now, but as we go into the future.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Ms. Adrians, Ms. Hoffer, I think that we go to you now.
The moment everyone's been waiting for, right, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
I have. That's, yeah, I have.
Both chairs. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I believe Ms. Burt has agreed to do the screen sharing duties today. So the document that we will be walking through, well, I should start with, you have three spreadsheets. So the document that we'll be walking through is the one that's the change item page. You also have a document that's titled 21 state aid and then 21 levies. So the levy page shows all of the levies in great detail, and the state aid shows all of the programs that are funded and then along with additional funding. So that would include the base appropriations along with the new proposed spending items. And so but what we're going to focus on today is just the change item page. And so what these numbers reflect is any additional funding that's being proposed by the House and the Senate over base funding. Thank you, Ms. Burt. And just to orient you a little bit, so the programs are in the first column, and then the House proposals are in the middle, and then the Senate proposals on the right. And Ms. Hofer and I will bounce back and forth just a bit, if that's okay. So we'll begin with the House provisions for the general education change. This is on line 12. What the House proposes is increasing the formula allowance by 2% each year in the first biennium, and then in the tails, so for 24 and 25, increasing the formula allowance by 0.5% in each of those years. And then the amount is not shown on the tracking, but the proposal would include increasing the formula and attaching it to the CPI, the consumer price index rate for inflation, starting in fiscal year 26 and beyond. The amount for the first biennium of the formula change is just under $400 million. And then in the tails, the amount is $685 million. On line 14, this is the compensatory provision that Mr. Strom referenced yesterday, where it removes, the language removes the concentration cap. This amount is $19.4 million in the first biennium and $21.7 million in the second biennium. The next line, this is the early programs alignment. What this recommendation does is it allows students who receive that early childhood special education services to also be eligible for English learner and services in pre-K breakfast. So this is the line, the cost for the English learner piece of that. The amount is $849,000 in the first biennium, and then $1.2 million in the second biennium. The proposal to increase revenue for English learners to try to address the cross-subsidy issue is $29 million in the first biennium and $31.5 million in the second. On line 17, what this shows is there is a provision that links any change in the formula to English learners, and that begins in fiscal year 24, so the cost for that doesn't start until the tails, and that cost is just over $1 million. On line 18, this is funding to provide extended time for students who are in residential treatment facilities, and the amount is $1.96 million, and that's in the tails, so that begins in fiscal year 24. On line 19, just like the providing the link to the formula for English learners, this links extended time revenue to the formula starting in fiscal year 24, and the cost for that is $821,000 in the tails. On line 20, this is the cost for maintaining the existing VPK seats, and so that's $39 million in the first biennium and $41.2 million in the second biennium. On line 21, the House proposal has a number of provisions that would impact levies. And so in order to maintain a zero levy change, what the bill does is it provides an aid offset to pay for those. And so the three programs that would have that levy interaction would be it would be for CTE, there's an LTFM provision and VPK changes. So they're all bundled up into this one line, and that amount is just under $8.5 million in the first biennium and $10.7 million in the second biennium. On line 22, this is the clarification of eligibility for PSEO, and it results in a savings. In the first biennium, it's $305,000, and in the second, it's $310,000. And then I'm going to jump down to line 26. This is transportation sparsity aid. It's, I believe Mr. Strom referenced this yesterday, it's an increase from 18.2% to 30% for the House position. That's $1.6 million in the first biennium, and then just under $4 million in the second biennium. And then on line 29, there's a provision in the House bill that to expand rigorous coursework, and this is the career and tech piece of that. And so it's $60,000 in the first biennium and $57,000 in the second. And I'm going to pass it over to Ms. Hofer.
Ms. Hofer.
Mr. Chair and members, I will begin on the Senate side, and I will go through the Senate's proposals for the first article, which was general education, and then I will go through the couple of Article 2 proposals, the education excellence proposals that are on page 1 before turning it over to Ms. Adriance again. So the first Senate proposal you'll see is on line 18 of the spreadsheet. And this proposal is similar to the House proposal to provide extended time for students in residential treatment facilities who participate in summer programming. The difference here is the Senate begins the program in fiscal year 2022. So for the 22-23 biennium, it's a cost of just under $2 million. And in the tails, it's just over $2 million. The next Senate proposal is on line 23. This proposal would expand the number of PSEO CTE courses that a 10th grade student could take. So for the 22-23 biennium, this is $280,000. And in the 24-25 biennium, it's $296,000. On line 24, this is the referendum equalization proposal that I spoke of yesterday. So this has both an aid and a levy component. Line 24 shows the aid impact. So this would increase referendum equalization aid by $23.6 million in the 22-23 biennium, and it would increase the tails by $46.4 million. And members, I do just want to give you the levy impact as well, since these work together. By increasing the equalization aid, there's a reduction in the referendum levy by $24.7 million in the 22-23 biennium and $43.3 million in the tails. On line 25 is a proposal that I spoke of yesterday to expand the definition of shared time revenue to include students who are participating in extended day CTE programs. In the 22-23 biennium, this is $382,000. In the tails, it's $756,000. On line 26, as Ms. Adriance mentioned, the Senate and the House have similar proposals for transportation sparsity aid. The Senate proposes increasing the pupil transportation adjustment from 18.2% to 70% of unreimbursed prior year costs. So for the 22-23 biennium, this is $15.3 million, and in the tails, it's $21.7 million. The next Senate proposal is on line 30. This is a proposal for Minnesota Classroom Support Aid. And under this proposal, it would be $60 million of one-time funding in fiscal year 2022. And as this proposal is in the appropriations section, I wanted to speak just briefly to this as we didn't hear about this one yesterday. So under this proposal, the Minnesota State Academies would receive $400,000. Each of the four intermediate districts would receive $400,000. And the remaining $58 million would be divided equally among school districts and charter schools on a per pupil basis. This funding would be based in part on the amount of federal ESSER Title I formula funding that a school district received. So school districts that received more than $5,000 per student of the ESSER 1, 2, and 3 Title I formula funding, their district total would be limited to $1 million of aid. On line 31 is the next Senate proposal. This proposal would provide non-public pupil aid for guidance and counseling services for all tribal contract and elementary non-public students. In the 22-23 biennium, this is $3.5 million, and in the tails, it's $4 million. Into the Education Excellence article, on line 37 is the first Senate proposal. This is for a grant for digital well-being to the Live More, Screen Less organization for $1.5 million in fiscal year 2022 only. On line 38 is a proposal for the education savings accounts. This proposal shows the net change of $11.5 million in the 22-23 biennium and $2.4 million in the 24-25 biennium. This proposal does have a levy impact, and if you're looking at the state aid spreadsheet, you'll notice that there are several lines impacted by this proposal as well. And this line here shows the net aid change. The net levy change of the proposal is in the tails only, and it's a reduction of levies by $46.1 million. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will allow Ms. Adrians to explain the education excellence proposals for the House before I complete the Senate's proposals.
Thank you, Ms. Helfer. Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the House provisions begin on line 34 with American Indian Education Aid. There are two different cost items here. The first provides an aid extension to the Joint Powers Districts. And this cost is $191,000 in the first biennium, and then $268,000 in the tails. And the second American Indian Education Aid, this is similar to the other, linked to the formula provisions, where it begins in fiscal year 24 with the formula increase there, and the cost is $175,000 in the tails. On line 36, this is an increase to the concurrent enrollment program, which is also known as College in the Schools. The increase over the base funding is $1 million additionally each year. On line 39, the House has a proposal for funding for equitable school enhancement grants. This is funded at $3 million each year. On line 40, this is the proposal to expand rigorous coursework, which is used to improve access to specific programs for underserved and underrepresented students. The amount is $3.73 million each year in the first biennium, and then $3.5 million each year in the second biennium. On line 41, this is funding for full service community schools. It's $5 million each year. On line 42, Girls in Action would be funded with $1.5 million in fiscal year 22 only. On line 43, this is a provision to provide Indigenous education for all. It's funded at $1.3 million in the first biennium, and then $874,000 in the second biennium. On line 44, this is an increase to the existing Math Corps program, and it would provide an additional $2 million each year. On line 45, there would be funding for Minnesota Civics Education Coalition. This is $150,000 in the first biennium only. On line 46, this is funding for the Minnesota Council on Economic Education, and it's $500,000 in the first biennium only. And then we'll move to the next page. The House provides funding for the Minnesota Youth Council, $187,000 each year. There's a provision for multi-tiered systems of support, and the funding for that is $5 million in each year. On line 49, both the House and the Senate provide additional funding for specific children's museums. The House provides funding for museums in Bloomington, Grand Rapids, and Mankato, and the funding for that is $150,000 each year. On line 51, this is a reduction to the college entrance exam reimbursement. It reduces it by that funding by $500,000 each year. On line 52, Rock and Read receives a reduction to its funding in 2021, and then in order for the program to be able to use that funding, it's reappropriated that same amount in fiscal year 22. On line 54, the House proposes an additional $4 million for the Santa Foundation in the first biennium, and then $2 million in the second biennium. On line 55, this is a proposal to reduce, it's a statewide testing reduction of funding that is not deemed necessary. And it's a savings of $2.4 million in the first biennium only. On line 56, this is a compensatory hold harmless provision for the tribal contract schools. And it is in the first biennium only at $50,000. And then on line 57, this is for the tribal contract schools as well, declining enrollment aid, and it would start in fiscal year 21 with $52,000, and then a cleanup payment in fiscal year 22 of $6,000. And I will pass it over to Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Continuing with the Senate's Article 2 proposals, on line 49, Ms. Adrians mentioned that both the House and Senate contain appropriations for the museums. On the Senate side, there is a new appropriation starting in fiscal year 2024 for the Children's Museum of Southern Minnesota in Mankato at $50,000 per year or $100,000 for the biennium. On line 50, the Senate proposes a grant to the McPhail Center for Online Access to Music Education. This would be $300,000 in the 22-23 biennium only. On line 51, the Senate also carries the proposal to right-size the college entrance exam reimbursements. So this would be a savings of $500,000 per year or $1 million per biennium. On line 53, the Senate proposes increasing the Rural Career and Technical Education Consortium grants by $2 million per year or $4 million per biennium. On line 54, the Senate also provides an appropriation to the Sana Foundation of $2 million in the 22-23 biennium only. On line 55, the Senate also carries the proposal to reduce the statewide testing appropriation in the 22-23 biennium by $2.4 million in lieu of federal funds. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Adrians, who will go through the teacher's article for the House.
Thank you. Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 60, the House proposes increasing funding for the American Indian Teacher Prep Grants with an additional $140,000 per year. On line 61, this is a proposal for anti-bias professional development. It would be a one-time funding of $4 million in fiscal year 22. On line 62, this is a proposal to provide $750,000 in fiscal year 22 for Black Men Teach. On line 63, this is a proposal to provide hiring bonuses for teachers to come teach in Minnesota. Ms. Parra described this yesterday, I believe, and it would be funded with $350,000 annually. On line 64, this is an increase for concurrent enrollment teacher partnership program with an additional $625,000 per year. On line 65, the CUGMIC grants, this is additional funding of $500,000 per year. On line 66, this is additional funding for the expanded concurrent enrollment program, also known as Intro to Teaching, with an additional $125,000 per year. On line 67, the House proposes increasing the Grow Your Own funding with an additional $14.8 million in the first biennium and $15.57 million in the second biennium. On line 69, this is funding for the Minnesota Science Teachers Association. It's a one-time amount of $611,000 in fiscal year 22 only. On line 70, there is funding for non-exclusionary discipline training at $5 million per year. On line 71, this is funding for paraprofessional training. It's $13.3 million in the first biennium and $14 million in the second biennium. On line 72, this is funding to receive a report on the increasing percentage of teachers of color. And it's the goal is to get the report every other year. So there's $15,000 in fiscal year 22 and then $15,000 in fiscal year 24. On line 73, this is funding for teachers of color for the mentoring and retention incentive grants. It's $4.5 million in the first biennium and $7.5 million in the second biennium. On line 74, this is a marketing campaign for teacher recruitment. It's $500,000 per year. And on line 75, this is funding to provide for tribal relations training for school leaders across the state, and it is $250,000 per year. I'll pass it over to Ms. Hofer.
Thank you. Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Senate's teacher proposals begin on line 62. The Senate also proposes a grant to the Black Men Teach Twin Cities organization of $750,000 in fiscal year 2022 only. On line 63, the Senate also proposes providing Come Teach in Minnesota hiring bonuses of $350,000 per year or $700,000 per biennium. On line 67, the Senate proposes increasing the Grow Your Own grant program by $2.5 million per year or $5 million per biennium. On line 68, the Senate provides a grant to letters. So this would be $3 million per year or $6 million per biennium. On line 73, the Senate also would increase the mentoring and retention incentive grants by $2.5 million in each biennium. On line 74, the Senate also provides an appropriation for the teacher recruitment marketing campaign of $500,000 per year or $1 million per biennium. And Mr. Chair, I'm going to go through just quickly the special education and health and safety articles since these are short, and then I'll turn it back over to Ms. Adrians. So in the special education article, the Senate has line 78, which provides an appropriation to MDE to develop guidance for clinical nursing services. This would be $100,000 in fiscal year 2022 only. In the health and safety article, the Senate proposed modifying the Safe Schools Revenue Program. So as I described yesterday, this has both an aid and a levy component to it. So on line 82, you can see the aid component, which would be a new funding of $16.4 million in the 22-23 biennium and $40.1 million in the TALES. And on the levy side, this would be a levy increase in the 22-23 biennium of $6.5 million and $13.5 million in the TALES. And then there's one final health and safety item on the Senate side, which is at the top of page three. It's line 84. The Senate provides an appropriation for grants for suicide prevention teacher training. This would be $265,000 in fiscal year 2022 only. And with that, I will turn it back over to Ms. Adrians. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hofer. Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we are on line 79. The House proposes funding to help reduce the special education cross-subsidy. The amount of funding in the first biennium is just over $70 million. And in the TALES, it is just over $110 million. Now we'll move to health and safety for the House proposal. On line 83, this is an amount to increase the number of student support personnel in districts across the state. It is $17.2 million starting in fiscal year 23, and that amount in the TALES is just over $43 million. Moving to the next page, the House has the same suicide prevention teacher training grants proposal as the Senate at $265,000 in fiscal year 22. And then the House also proposes funding for trauma-informed grants, $6 million each year in the first biennium only. And then we'll move to the nutrition article on line 88. Mr. Strom walked through the community eligibility provision, and this is the aid for that. It's $2.5 million just one time in fiscal year 23. And then as I referenced before, the early programs alignment, this is the school breakfast portion of that proposal. It would be $285,000 each year. And I believe Ms. Hofer is taking it from here.
Thank you. Ms. Hofer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I will discuss the libraries article, which begins on line 92. Both the House and the Senate provide an increase to the basic system support for libraries at just slightly different amounts. The House provides $3.8 million in the 22-23 biennium and $4 million in the TALES, while the Senate provides $3 million in the 22-23 biennium and $3.2 million in the TALES. And I'll turn it back to Ms. Adrians, who will go through the early childhood article.
Thank you. Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 95, the House proposes funding that would go to the Children's Cabinet via MMB for an early childhood governance report that would be $250,000 in fiscal year 22 only. And the House proposes additional funding for early learning scholarships at the amount of just under $37 million in the first biennium and $38.5 million in the second biennium. And I would like to point out that the Senate also has a proposal to fund for additional funding for early learning scholarships as well. That proposal is not in the education bill, but it's in the Health and Human Services proposal. I believe it's Senate File 2360. And that proposes funding scholarships with the CCDBG ARP money. And I believe it's $73 million in fiscal year 22 and $73 million in fiscal year 23. I just wanted to point that out. And then on line 97, the House proposes another Children's Cabinet via MMB proposal for the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Task Force. This would be funded at $500,000 in fiscal year 22. On line 98, there's additional funding for the kindergarten entrance assessment. It's $4.2 million in the first biennium and $3.6 million in the second. On line 99, this is additional funding for the Parent-Child Plus program, $600,000 each year. On line 100, this is funding for Reach Out and Read Minnesota. It's $150,000 annually. On line 101, this is funding for a tribal early learning package. It's $3.3 million each year. And then we'll move to the community education article. And the House proposal is to increase funding for the Education Partnerships Program. These are the grants for Tier 1 and Tier 2. It would be an additional $2 million each year, which would be split about evenly between the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 grants. And then I'll pass that to Ms. Over.
Mr. Chair, thank you. On line 104 is the Senate's proposal to increase community education revenue. This has both an aid and a levy component to it. So you can see on line 104 that the aid would increase by $2.9 million in the 22-23 biennium and $26.3 million in the TALES. And on the levy side, the levy would increase by $3 million in the 22-23 biennium and $6.3 million in the TALES. And I'll turn it back over to Ms. Adrians, who will go through the lifelong learning article.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 108, this is increased funding for high school equivalency tests. It's $125,000 each year. And then we'll move to the agency budgets on line 111 to provide funding for the proposal to gather an American Indian student count. The funding for that is $1.32 million in the first biennium and $865,000 in the second. There is a proposal to work on the data submission modernization. That is $6.6 million in the first biennium and $6.5 million in the second. The next House proposal is on line 114. This would add ethnic studies to the standards and curriculum that districts use, and this cost is $292,000 in the first biennium and $296,000 in the second. On line 115, a proposal to expand language access for families. This is $3 million each year. On line 116, both the House and the Senate have a reduction of $2 million for the legal costs in fiscal year 21, and then an increase in the appropriation in fiscal year 22 for the House is $4.5 million, just in that one year alone. On line 117, the House proposes increasing the operating adjustment at the amount of $1.1 million in the first biennium and $1.5 million in the second biennium. And then on line 118, this is an operating holdback provision to reduce the funding at $1.25 million just in fiscal year 21 alone. And then on line 120, this is the administrative piece of the VPK proposal to maintain the existing seats. The cost is $340,000 each year. And I will pass it back to Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Senate's proposals for the state agencies begin on line 113. The Senate provides an appropriation to the Department of Education for IT costs related to the Education Innovation Zone program. It says $13,000 in fiscal year 2022 only. On line 116, as Ms. Adrians mentioned, the Senate also reduces the legal costs for litigation to the Department of Education by $2 million in fiscal year 2021, and the Senate reappropriates that $2 million in fiscal year 2022. On line 117, the Senate adjusts the operating budget for the Department of Education. It's a reduction of $2.4 million in the 22-23 biennium and $2.3 million in the TALES. On line 118, the Senate also reduces the operating holdback for the Department of Education by $1.3 million in fiscal year 2021 only. On line 119, as described yesterday, the Senate proposed suspending academic standards review. And as a result, the Senate reduces the department's budget by $40,000 in fiscal year 2022, and then reappropriates that $40,000 for academic standards review in fiscal year 2024. And that gets us through page three. So members, if you'll turn to page four, Ms. Adrians will continue with the rest of the state agencies.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're almost done. The House has some proposed changes for PELSBY on line 123. This is a small cost in order to cover the cost of providing substitute teachers for the new teacher members of in order to expand the board. In that way, the cost of that is $4,000 per year. On line 124, the House proposes increasing the operating budget for PELSBY $193,000 in the first biennium and $240,000 in the second. On line 125, there's a cost to provide funding for the teacher prep program approval process. It's one time in fiscal year 22 only, and that's $60,000. On line 128, the House proposes increasing the operating budget for the Minnesota State Academies at the amount of $778,000 in the first biennium and just over $1 million in the second biennium. And then on line 131, the House proposes increasing the operating budget for the Purpich School, $351,000 in the first biennium and $466,000 in the second biennium. Now I'll let Ms. Hofer cover the agencies for the Senate.
Thank you, Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. On line 132, the Senate proposes closing the Purpich Center for Arts Education. This has both an aid and a levy impact. You can see that the aid impact is a reduction to the general fund of $2.3 million in the 22-23 biennium and a reduction of $10.1 million in the TALES. There is a slight levy increase as a result of this proposal and the Purpich Center students returning to the public school system and then generating those state aids and levies. So that would be an increase of $317,000 in the 22-23 biennium and an increase of $688,000 in the TALES. On line 135, members, you'll see some tax interactions as a result of the levy proposals. For the Senate, the property tax refunds would be reduced by about $1.3 million in the 22-23 biennium, and there'd be a general fund savings of $5.5 million in the TALES as a result of the Senate's proposal that on a statewide basis, property taxes for education levies would be lower by $13.4 million in the 22-23 biennium, and they'd be lower by $66.2 million in the TALES. And I will turn it back to Ms. Adrians to describe the tax interactions for the House bill.
Thanks. Thank you, Ms. Hofer. Ms. Adrians.
Mr. Chair and members, the House similarly has tax interactions. And so due to the lower property tax burden because of the levy interactions in the House proposal, it would result in reduced state paid homeowner property tax refunds at the amount of $80,000 in fiscal year 23 and $140,000 in the TALES. And then we'll move down to the revenue line starting on line 139. And what this shows is the fiscal year 21 carry forward. So all the result of any of the fiscal year 21 proposals, which you can see actually on line 136, It's $3.275 million. So this just allows us to adjust the fiscal year 22 by that amount. So it reduces the spending in fiscal year 22 by $3.275 million. And then on line 140, there is a small interaction with income taxes. The higher property tax burden on the non-homestead properties increases the income tax deductions that would be allowable starting in fiscal year 23. And this is just $10,000 each year, starting that year. And then on line 141, this is the amount of revenue that would be brought in by increasing the Pelsby application fee from $57 to $85. And that amount is $861,000 each year. And I will turn it back over to Ms. Hofer.
Thank you, Ms. Hofer.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. We are back up on line 139. As Ms. Adrians described, the fiscal year 2021 carry forward is essentially an accounting mechanism to reduce spending in the 22-23 biennium. So for the Senate, because there are some revenue changes in fiscal year 2021, that impacts the spending in fiscal year 2021. So you'll see that there is a carry forward of $3.1 million in fiscal year 2022, and that number comes from line 145 below. On line 140, the Senate also has an income tax interaction as a result of lowering statewide property taxes for education. This will lower the amount of income tax deductions for property taxes. And so there would be an increase to the general fund of $170,000 in fiscal year 2023 and an increase to the general fund of $1 million in the 24-25 biennium. On line 142, as Ms. Lewis described yesterday, the Senate proposes allowing Pelsby to extend the renewal period for teacher licensure for 6 months. As a result, this will reduce teacher licensure revenue in fiscal year 2021 by $171,000. And then that same revenue is expected 6 months later in fiscal year 2022. So it's an increase of $171,000. So as a result of the spending and revenue changes on line 145, you can see that for fiscal year 2021, the Senate reduces general fund spending by $3.1 million. In fiscal year 2022, there's an increase of $152.1 million. And in the 24-25 biennium, there's an increase of $146.8 million. And then on the levy side for the 2022-2023 biennium, levies are reduced by $13.4 million. And in the TALES, levies are reduced on a statewide basis by $66.2 million. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Hofer.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just, I failed to mention the bottom line for the House proposal. So the overall impact for fiscal year 21, as I mentioned, is the reduction in spending of $3.275 million. And the overall increase in spending for the first biennium is just under $773 million. And in the TALES, it's $1.12 billion.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Members, any questions for Ms. Adrians or Ms. Hofer? Okay, seeing none. Chair Chamberlain, the House would now like to just, I think, briefly review the eight items that are sames between the two bills, just to identify. They're not all the same, so I want to identify for you and your conferees the ones that we would suggest considering first. And members should have received a PDF of those before the committee convened this afternoon. And the first one, Mr. Chair, Representative Hassan has authored this bill regarding religious observances and students. Representative Hassan, would you like to just speak briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So Article 1 in general education
Section one is the absence from religious observance. This section requires the school board to notify parents of the district's policy relating to absence from school for religious observance. And the language is slightly, the wording is different, but it's my belief that it's the same intent. And the idea behind this bill was that for our non-Christian students celebrating their holidays, that our schools would just acknowledge that and put that in the school calendar so that we have more inclusive school experience.
Thank you very much. The next provision is Article 1. Let me make sure I get this right. Section 17, I believe it is. And this is related to compensatory education and report related to the use of those funds. And I believe this is one that speaks to evidence-based practices. And staff can correct me if I'm mistaken about that. The next two are Article 1, Section 19 and Section 21. These are, Chair Chamberlain, you chaired the Tax Committee. These are what I would identify as technical language around excess increments that we both have very similar provisions in our bills. You have an explicit effective date and we do not. Then looking at the next provision, the notification of environmental hazards. Chair Richardson, this is a provision that you've been carrying. If you could speak to that briefly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a provision that is the same both in the House and the Senate bill. And it just simply requires that if there is a known environmental hazard, that schools are required to provide notice to students and parents.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Article 9, Section 11, a limit on screen time. Mr. Chair, we know that the screen time issues are important to you. Representative Pryor, would you like to speak to this?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And similar to some of our other provisions, the wording is slightly different, but the intent is the same. And in particular, this is something that came from our early childhood committee, and understanding how at the youngest age is when it's most critical to have that interaction with the adult. And so very similar language, and we would count that as the same.
Thank you very much. Next provision is Article 11, Section 11. Representative Kreisha, this was a provision of Representative Bennett's. I wonder if you'd like to speak to it briefly. Appears Representative Kreisha has stepped away. Members, Representative Bennett brought this provision forward 2 years ago as well, and it encourages that grants given out demonstrate use of evidence-based best practices, attempt to kind of narrow and focus our grant making and maybe get more bang for the buck, as it were. We carried this in our omnibus bill 2 years ago as well, and liked it enough to bring it back this time. And last on our list, Mr. Chair, Article 11, Section 12, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This just relates to an obsolete reference, and the provision is the same with both the House and the Senate.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Richardson. Mr. Chair, that completes the House's agenda for today. Do you have a preview of coming attractions that you could share for those gathering again tomorrow at 1?
Yes, we have some coming attractions. So tomorrow, members, we'll have some testimony on some different pieces of the bill, innovations, distance learning, just to refamiliarize ourselves with the digital well-being issue and a couple other things. And secondly, we will take a look at these SAMEs. I don't see any huge problem here, and then I would be prepared to adopt those tomorrow. So those two things. We'll have some testimony and some other bill items, and then be prepared to adopt these eight SAMEs. That's all right?
Sounds like a plan, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you all. Have a good evening. We are adjourned.